Hello and welcome back to Tabletop Dropouts. I'm George.
I'm Zach.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to talk to you guys about some more tabletop gaming goodness. How are you guys doing today? It's been about, a week since we recorded last?
Yeah, so it's almost a week to the day.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm doing great, for one. I am currently staring at my brand new Flesh Eater Court army, and I am a happy panda. So.
They're very gross in typical zombie gross fashion.
No, they're chivalrous. And
I will say that's my favorite bit, is that somehow the Bretonians just went crazy and became, you know, zombies.
Yeah, oh, yeah, no, like, it was because Nagash made them think that they were noble knights, when in reality they're just a bunch of, like, corpse-eating zombies.
It's great, man.
It's incredible. It's just such a fun and dark and just
I've got to hunt down some, like, Bretonian bits and just put them on the army, kind of, like, interspersed throughout, and kind of flavor it up.
Oh, man, just, awesome. Just troll it.
Yeah.
Just troll some Bretonians player, make him cry a little bit when he sees the models that are just not in Sigmar anymore.
This is where I would put my army if I had one anymore.
Look what they did to my boy!
So, when I first started making that Squig army, the lore I came up with was that they found a bunch of Bretonian armor. So I was on a hunt for the little animal crest that used to be on the Pegasus Knights and all them. And I was going to put them on all the freaking helmets. All the armored Squig Rider helmets were going to have Bretonian crests. That proves to be very expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty much any time you're getting into anything that's not in the regular line, you're just...
So, as you can tell from our conversation, we're currently very high on Age of Sigmar at the moment. After last week, we managed to convince Zach to join the Brotherhood of Fantasy and join the Grand Alliance of Death. Mike and I played a Death versus Chaos game earlier today and had a blast. We'll be talking about that a little bit later.
Yeah, but, and we actually did one last week too after we finished recording episode one. Squigs
after.
Versus Death. So yeah. Legions of Nagash versus...
Did not go well for the Squigs.
Well, we'll get to that.
We'll talk about that later. Obviously right now, as we talked about last week and we're going to talk a little bit more this week, 40K is in a state of flux, right? We've got the, I'm going to use the quotes here, core rules for it in the form of that download that that they put out right after the whole rule book basically leaked online. But it's really not for most armies in a playable state because we don't have points. Unless you want to play power level, you can't jump on the new edition yet.
Yeah. You know, and actually I've seen some conversations about that, so I guess we'll do like a mini state of the narrative. I mean, not state, yeah, state of the narrative.
State of the meta.
State of the meta. Thank you. We'll do a mini state of the meta kind of within news. Yeah, and I guess, you know, nobody really knows, so disclaimer from the last episode carries over. We've seen like the core rules leak, and I know a couple of guys have been playing with 9th edition rules. However, I'm still of the opinion that I'm, you know, in 8th edition, I'll start playing 9th once 9th drops because I have to have the rule book in my hand to actually do it.
So. And one thing I saw a lot of earlier, before I came over here today, a couple of YouTubers have gotten the books, gotten the Indominus box, and one of them, he actually did a read through of the rules and he talked about how the game played and the changes that he thought. And this is a guy that's been playing since like first or second edition 40K, so he's got a lot of history. And he kind of did a deep dive on the rules, and it sounds like it's going to be really interesting, but one of the things he talked about is all the games they've played to practice so far, they've just gone off of power level, because power level, as of right now, doesn't seem to be changing for the units. But he's like, one of them plays orcs, and he plays knights. He was playing Imperial Knights, and he's like, I don't know how the detachments are going to work for Imperial Knights because they had special rules that made them cheaper for them to get their super heavy. That doesn't exist yet. Until we get the updates, it's kind of hard to, I guess.
How to really figure it out. Yeah, and you know, you talk about points and power level possibly not increasing. I mean, GW never updated power level after it was introduced in 8th edition, so I don't suspect that they're going to do it now. Yeah. And with points, I mean, honestly, if you want to start playing 9th edition, just write a 1750 point list. Because all the points are going up, so you know, cut at least 10% of your points out, at least, and then maybe that'll be a fair approximation of what 9th will actually look like.
They did just change the table size to, you know, its smaller size, everything that I've seen in the leaks is that everything's going up in points. I didn't see a single points drop. Correct me if I'm wrong.
The one points leak I saw for the Marines, some of the Marines units netted a discount, but I think it was like some of the transports. There was one unit, and I'm just trying to do this off the top of my head. You might know what I'm talking about, Zach. There was one where the unit went up in points cost, but it war gear went down.
Right.
So it netted cheaper.
I think what that is that war gear is now like just inherently part of X unit.
Which I am a big fan of because we were talking about that off podcast last time. I hate the way that you have to buy every war gear. I would much rather, and I may be an outlier, and it's because I'm coming in from Age of Sigmar, but I'd much rather just be like, here's a profile for this guy with this war gear loadout. And then here's another profile for a very similar unit, but with a different war gear loadout. Just makes list building easier.
Sure, yeah. And I think that, you know, there's something to be said for both sides of that coin. Yeah, I mean, I both appreciate the granularity that you can get into with, you know, kitting out each one of your, you know, 60 dudes with different stuff. But I also see, you know, hey, it's a lot easier to just be like, here's 2,000 points. This is what it's always armed with. Bam, done.
Yeah, and I feel like the... For me personally, the granularity works a lot better in something like Kill Team or Necromunda, where I'm dealing with like six or seven guys. Because then if I'm playing, you know, a 2,000 point game and I'm going very troop heavy, I got to remember, are these the guys with this or with option A or option B?
Mm-hmm.
And especially since due to toolkit nature of a lot of these war gears, I'm like, oh, these are, I need to make sure I know where my guys that have the AP are so they can go crack that armor, where these are the guys that are just going to put out a ton of firepower.
Yeah. So, I mean, hey, 9th edition is like signing up for a new college course, in my opinion. So, I mean, I'm expecting to have 6 months where I am a terrible 40K player, well, more so than usual, and don't know what I'm doing. But I'm looking forward to it. Also looking forward to picking up Sigmar. I'm sure that I'm going to get all the rules confused and have no idea what I'm doing in both games. So it'll be great.
I'm
looking forward to painting this new army, definitely. So.
Sigmar is, I mean, we actually, you know, we kind of did our game, and I hadn't played a game of Sigmar in probably 6 to 8 months. Just kind of had my army sitting around. I think the last time I played was with a guy from Guardians Club, like back in, I mean, way before COVID. I want to say probably December, November time frame. I played his Cities of Sigmar list. I forgot how fun it really was and how easy it actually is to. And there's still that kind of, I have to remember that this guy does this or that these guys do this. And you know, it's kind of, you have to remember that stuff just as much as you do with 40K. But it's a lot easier to kind of, okay, this is what you're doing. This is how it's going to go. This is the profile. Whereas in, you know, 40K, it's a little more.
Yeah, it's I find in, for me, for Age of Sigmar, it's a lot easier for me to internalize what all the stuff does after a few playthroughs. With 40K, even after, that's all I was playing because that's what you guys were wanting to play. I was still having to flip through my printout of my army list, trying to remember what each war gear option did, what each command trait did.
Dude, I still do the same thing. I mean, cheat sheets are the way to go. You know, don't feel like you have to memorize all the stuff. It's good to have, you know, a good understanding. I think last podcast we talked about, you should probably know what a bolt gun does if you're playing Space Marines. But like, you know, cheat sheets are great. So I think
The cool thing about Sigmar is that you really only need the Battle Tome and the core rulebook. And then once you kind of understand the rules, you don't really need the core rulebook very much. You just kind of need your Battle Tome. So you have your battalions, and then you have the scrolls that you need. And then I buy the War Scroll cards mainly because it's cool. Like,
yeah, they're really good as a table reference. But
I'm absolutely going to buy them.
Yeah, I mean, you should.
And on Amazon, I'll do that right now.
Yeah, the one problem, and you might run into this right now, is they do small runs of them, so if they might be gone, which...
Gotta go hunting.
Yeah, you might have to go to some dark places dark on the web to find it. actually, talk about Age of Sigmar makes me want to bring up something I'm really excited about. I know I'd message you guys about it when they announced it, and the preview is supposed to be, I think, going up today. The fact that they're introducing Create Your Own Character narrative rules in the General's Handbook.
Oh, yeah, because the General's Handbook 2020...
Pre-orders this weekend.
I have already got my pre-order in.
Your pre-order?
Yep.
Did you pre-ordered it?
I got a guy.
Yeah, the fact that... That's honestly from... When I started playing, it was Fantasy Battles 4th or 5th edition. And you basically were making your own heroes. Like, they had the named heroes, but it was like... you were fully kitting out a guy. And they kind of moved away with that. And when I came back, and Path to Glory kind of gives you a taste of that, where you pick a guy and you can kind of pick up a few abilities. But depending on how they implement this, this has some really, really good narrative play, campaign play potential, which I know we have a few things we've kind of talked about trying to do in the future.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
hopefully definitely. This will play into that.
Yeah. I mean, that's true.
Not to pivot back too much to 40K, but I know that that's, I think it's called Conquest or something.
Yeah,
that's
Conquest.
Part of the new edition. And, you know, I actually tried to run a narrative campaign probably maybe a year ago up at my local store. And I got a lot of input and people, well, not input, but a lot of interest. I think we had like 18 people signed up. And that was way too much, first of all. and unfortunately, it kind of petered out. It was just... you know, people weren't playing their games, unfortunately, but I'm excited to see a rule set codified.
Did you see any of the videos about by people going through the rule book? Apparently that Crusader is about 50 pages of rules.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So like, it's like tables of like injuries your guys can pick up and how experience works.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited about the prospect of us being able to play a narrative campaign. Mm-hmm. And just getting in there and actually seeing our armies grow and change over time.
Yeah, that'll be neat. I guess kind of, you know, we're still doing news. We've had General's Handbook coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Hashtag excited. Obviously, 40K, everyone knows. What's the other thing? Oh, yeah, LVO tickets went on sale, I think, this week. LVO, Las Vegas Open, it's kind of the year end for the ITC tournament circuit. Obviously, this year is a little bit weird with ITC, in that we've had not anywhere near as many tournaments as we technically should have had by now, you know, obviously with COVID and everything. And that's kind of my big thing with LVO. You know, when I got into tournament play and competitive play pretty heavily a couple of months ago, I was all about it. I was looking forward to saving up my money. But now I'm not so sure.
What's the actual date on the LVO?
I believe late January.
So, oh, wow.
So,
okay,
it is feasible, you know, that we'll get this whole thing under control. Not going to go, you know, too into that, obviously. This is a gaming podcast,
yeah,
an epidemiology podcast. But, I'm not too certain on it. I believe, though, that they are offering some kind of guarantee they have to cancel. So,
yeah,
hopefully it goes off. I hope so. I'd love us to be back to normal. But
yeah, I'm sure that like any of the other big cons that happened this year, they have a bit of a war chest set up to refund if they have to.
Hopefully. Yeah, I know that was a big concern for Adepticon was, will Adepticon happen next year?
Just like another one I know that was pretty big was Dice Tower Con down in Orlando, big board game convention.
Yeah.
And they had to cancel this year, obviously, because it's normally, it would be going on this weekend.
Yeah.
But that was one of the things they talked about is, if these are your options, but if you take this option, we don't know if we'll be able to do anything next year.
Right, yeah, and I know a lot of those cons, you know, gave you the ability to donate to the con to ensure that, you know, it happens, and thankfully people have been doing that, so it looks like we will have a robust tournament scene still. You know, you talked about cons down in Orlando. Crucible isn't happening this year.
Oh, really? Yeah, because that should be in a few months. And
Crucible is usually in October, believe. I think what they're going to do is have... They're not canceling it this year. They're rescheduling it to next year. So we're going to have two Crucibles.
No, they'll probably do like an early, like probably March.
I think it's March, actually. Yeah. I think March and October. So, I mean, that'll be cool. You know, again, hopefully everything will be back to normal. Then we can go about, you know, the way we were doing things before. My wife's a big Disney fan. So she'll be able to go to Disney and I'll be able to go to Crucible and it'll work out.
Best for
it'll
everybody.
It'll be great, you know?
So now that we've kind of, I feel like we've kind of covered everything for the, big gorilla of the market of the miniature world in the form of GW's products and the events that are closely tied to them. But one thing I wanted to kind of touch on, and we talked about a little bit with the launch of kind of plugging the launch of Warcaster last time, and Mike bringing up Frostgrave 2.0. But there are, and I didn't really realize it till I started doing some, like going back over some of the recent news, there are a ton of big games either launching new editions or launching in this summer block. And I know it's probably because of Gen Con, when Gen Con was supposed to be. Like, I know that's the case with Warcry, but like Frostgrave is, as far as indie games go, is fairly big.
Yeah.
Then you've got the new edition of Relic Blade, which Relic Blade I've plugged a few times, but that's a growing community. But the really big one that we didn't talk about at all is Infinity.
Oh yeah.
So like, I don't know how much you guys keep up with it. It's one of those games that I've like looked out and gone, if I had a play group, I would probably invest heavily in this. I have like a couple of, I think I have two little 5-man squads to like do a starter game, but they just basically did their version of, and I don't want to call it their version of Kill Team because it's really doesn't compare. They did their on-ramp game first. It's called Infinity Code 1.
Okay.
Simplified rules. Only 4 big factions, but it's a precursor to what they're, I think they call it N4, is that they all their additions are N1, N2, N3.
Mm, I think they're on N3 right now, right?
They're in N3 right now. They're going to be launching N4, and all of the stuff from Code 1 will carry over into N4 with additional rules layers on top.
Hmm.
And it's just something interesting to contemplate, the fact that so many games are coming out right now with new additions or just, like I said, brand new games launching. Warcaster is a significant new game for one of the bigger companies in the space. You know, it's, for a while, I remember Privateer Press was probably GW's biggest competitor. I know they slipped down a little bit with third edition War Machine, from my understanding. I'd kind of gotten out of the War Machine scene by then.
And also Mantic kind of got a surge after Sigmar came out, because a lot of people from Fantasy Battles migrated to Kings of War.
They wanted that rank and flank.
Right, they wanted the old Fantasy Battles thing, which, I mean, I've looked at Kings of War too, and Kings of War definitely looks really cool. If I had, just like with Infinity, if I had a playgroup to actually who played that game, I would maybe pick up an army. But since I don't, I haven't had a lot of hands-on time with the models. I've looked at them on pictures, but I don't know how they actually look. Can I paint them? What do they look like? Do I like the sculpts? There's
honestly, a lot of questions. I think that's the biggest reason that a lot of these companies struggle to get a foothold in compared to GW, is GW has an infrastructure that facilitates building a community in their area. Like, we have the stores, which means the products are regularly available, and they, from my understanding, operate those stores as loss leaders. They accept that I'm probably going to go buy the FLGS because I'm going to get a better deal there, but I'm still buying their product in the end, so they're still making their money. Obviously, they prefer me to go buy the GW store at the full retail rate, but they've made that money on that plastic either way. But it's an intro store where someone who doesn't know anything about the hobby can get in, maybe learn how to paint, get sold on the game and the IP, and then take it out into the community.
Yeah, you know, I've had conversations with people that work for Games Workshop, and, you know, I mean, they have the metrics on all that. I think the number that was shared with me was, if they can get somebody into the hobby, that means they're going to make $800 off that person this year, which, sounds like a lot. I have probably already spent $800 on Games Workshop products this year. So
we're not going to talk about how much money we spend on GW products, please.
I am an adult.
I just don't want to acknowledge it to myself.
The one thing that I did kind of say, and Zach kind of brought this up when we were talking about the new objective markers, are a 40mm base. You kind of said my neoprene objective markers may not be good anymore. And that brought up a conversation where Games Workshop and Warhammer support the secondary market, mm-hmm. right? So if you're looking for stuff for Warhammer, you may not buy Warhammer, Games Workshop, Citadel stuff. You may go out and buy some Tinker Turf to play Necromunda, or you may go buy neoprene objective markers from a company like FLG, or you may buy a playmat from somewhere else.
Or you may even buy paints from like either the Privateer or Vallejo or any of the other modelings.
And the thing is like Games Workshop has its own, but allows that kind of, you know, other companies come in and they say, yeah, we make those neoprene objective markers. We make those pieces for you to buy, that you don't have to buy the same stuff. And that's kind of why I think Warhammer is so popular, is it's got this secondary market where you can pick up stuff that suits your aesthetic instead of setting up everybody else's. You're not following something that's mandated, hard-lined by a company. You can make your own aesthetic.
I will say, though, that it kind of creates an interesting scenario talking about the objective markers for new 40K. Because isn't it basically now, it used to be that objectives were just an infinitely small point on the map, and your neoprene mat that you're talking about, the neoprene objective markers, were just there.
The neoprene objective markers, for anyone that hasn't seen them, basically they have the little like central point, obviously, and they're a circle, and it's a 3-inch radius.
Yeah, 3-inch radius.
So if you're touching that bad boy, you're on that objective.
But now with the new addition, they actually have expanded. They have upgraded the size of the objective, which means that, well, is it 40 millimeter or 30 millimeter?
40 mic. Yeah.
So 40 millimeter. So now you have to go out an additional 40 millimeters from that 3-inch radius. So it's going to drive the manufacturers of these neoprene mats to make new product.
Yeah.
They're going to have to if they want to keep selling to the 40K crowd, which we've already covered. It's the big crowd. It's who you're going to chase if you're in that secondary market.
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about secondary markets, when you brought up paint, we missed something. The only rule that I actually want to like talk about now.
Well, actually, I actually did have one segment I wanted to ask you guys about, and this may be a little on the spot, but I wanted to see, out of the rules that have leaked, what was something you really dug and what was something you hated.
Okay, mine's the same rule for dug and hated, actually. So
Mike,
to be honest with you, I liked a lot of the rules that are coming out with for 9th. I think that I'm still the biggest rules thing, and I think I talked about this last, was the terrain rules. Mm-hmm. I'm still into it. I'm still happy about it. I can't wait for it. Because I get to hide a bloodthirster behind a 5-inch tall building, and you can't see it. Hulk hiding.
I'm just imagining him holding a shrub in front of his eyes. He's just like, you can't see me.
You can't target me.
Somebody please model that.
Or send us an art. We'd love it.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, so I'll give a serious one and then the one that's actually in my heart. So I think the thing that maybe the most significant one to me is, how they're reducing the ability to string your models out with coherency. Basically, before you just had to have each one of your dudes within 2 inches of another dude in that unit. And now it's like, you almost have to have him. It's I think specifically you have to have him within 2 inches of two other models of the same
unit. If there are six or more in the unit. So small guys can still form like a little 5-man firing line.
Okay.
But the second you go above six, they have to be within two of each other.
Yeah. And I think the way that that's going to affect is things like, you know, the possessed bomb are going to be a little bit less powerful, specifically because the possessed bomb is usually a board control item, especially if you're running an Alpha Legion Nurgle and get it to that sweet, sweet -3 to hit, which is also going away. You won't be able to like stretch out across 40 inches of tabletop now and have someone that's on one end of the board being affected by a Master of Possessions that's on the other end of the board. That's kind of going away, or at least
I mean, that's going to go away because you won't be able to. It becomes almost impossible to conga line.
Mm-hmm.
And you still can do it, but you have to you have to do it at least two deep.
Yeah.
And make these little mini
triangles.
You have
to have two parallel lines. Yeah.
But then you're super putting yourself at risk because the second I break your I kill one model, that's at least one other model gone from coherency rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of people will be less inclined to do it, especially if they start putting in, this might be already in 40K, it's just not models I'm familiar with. Age of Sigmar has stuff like giants and certain catapults that can just kill them. They don't target a unit. They just kill a specific model. And if they ever put rules like that, because that's a limiting factor in Age of Sigmar, which has very similar coherency rules,
mm-hmm.
where the giant will just reach into the middle of your line and go, oh, you strung yourself out too far. I plugged that one guy out and now half your unit's dead because they just ran away and fled because, you know, Bob the halberdier just got shoved in a giant's pocket. It makes sense, but...
Yeah. And of course, you know, GW's moving to this because they are trying to reduce the gaming of the game, if that makes sense, taking out opportunities for people to abuse the rules in ways that were unintended. GW's always wanted this to be a very cinematic and narrative-driven game, and they are embracing the competitive community a little bit more, it looks like, in 9th. However, you know, they still want you to kind of like, come on, guys, if that makes sense. They want you to read and interpret these rules as they were obviously meant to be interpreted, not as written.
Yeah, I mean, but how many times have you read, I mean, Storm of Iron, any of those novels? Like, how many times has a guard line been broke by a Chaos Incursion or a Xenos Incursion? And then everybody loses their minds and stuff just goes nuts. And they start running around. And that's kind of what I think they're trying to get their board to mimic what the behavior is on our...
100%, I agree. That they're trying to make it so that the game systems encourage what the IP's already been doing in their novels, in their video game licenses. It makes sense because, you know, the guard is supposed to eventually break whenever the Chaos Warriors show up because the Chaos Space Marines are some of the baddest dudes in the universe.
Yeah.
And the you know, the guard just can't compare to that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, on that note, while they're trying to move to that, we're never going to get to that actual state.
Oh, no.
No,
because
if we were
actually there, it would be like my three Chaos Space Marines versus 1,000 Guardsmen, and they'd still win every time. And then for every three Chaos Space Marines that I have, there'd be like 0.0001 like custodes somewhere. So, I mean, obviously we're never going to get there. The game's never going to perfectly mimic what the actual narrative is, and that's fine. You know?
It's a good ideal.
Yeah.
It's a good ideal to strive for, but
I will say that the thing from the rules that I'm digging is actually coherency, but it's a different aspect of coherency. Mm-hmm. I like that they're finally officially putting into rules the verticality, the 5-inch up for coherency and 5 inches up for engagement.
Yeah. The reason that I laugh at that was, I can't remember what Facebook group it was on, but one of the, you know, the menagerie of 40K things that I follow on social media posted a right angle triangle, and everyone that actually knows math will have to forgive me because I don't, but something about how, like, oh, finally, I get to use the Pythagorean theorem in something. Like, Mrs. Jones was right. I'll use this every day. I know that seems to be possible material for the salt mine. It seems like there's some weird interactions there. I just haven't dug into that very much.
I haven't looked at it too closely, but my whole thing is that if you're going to make a game that has terrain of variable heights, and considering GW has official terrain kits that are obviously designed to put people up at elevated positions, that needs to be supported in your rules. And I feel like previous cohesion rules were just like, nope, you all got to be on the same level.
So does this, and correct, I didn't get to read the full thing, but 5 inches directly up?
It says and I'm trying to remember the exact wording on it, and I'm going to fail horribly, so I'm not even going to try for that long. Basically just says that if a unit is 5 inches up, it still could be counted in...
Within
engagement and within coherency.
But it has to be directly above you?
I don't think...
See, that's the thing that I don't know.
I think this is where all the rules lawyering is going to come into effect. They're trying to get away from the gamey, but it's still going to happen. It's just going to manifest in different ways. And I think that the 5-inch...
Once we have the actual physical rule book in our hands, because I know that the rules are being presented in two ways. There's like a bullet point. Here's the intention behind the rules, the rough explanation. And then there's the very legalese official write-up for the rule that we're going to have to go to whenever someone has a question or someone tries to game the system.
You know what? And I'd like to give a future props to GW, because from the leaked core rules and then the, you know, officially leaked core rules from GW, what we've seen is they are actually bullet pointing. I had made a big whiny, salty post on one of our groups about how, like, why can't they just bullet point this stuff? Because the teases that they were showing us was just, you know, wall of text. And it's horrible to try to figure out. So.
And I think, like I said, from what I understand is in the actual books, and I haven't looked at the official rules, condensed rules, PDF, I think it's the same way there. You have that block of legalese text, it's super dense.
Yeah.
And then you have like three bullet points that sums up everything.
Yeah, and it's pretty great. Obviously, because I again made a couple of whiny reactionary messages to a few of my friends about disembarking. You do need to read the actual legalese and then read the bullet points. I think there was one, and I just misread it. It seemed to suggest that troops that are disembarking cannot charge that turn, which basically means, like, if that was the rule, I'm lighting my poor berserkers on fire because they'll never see another game. But I was just misinterpreting. So, again, you know, go back in, read it, blah.
So what's the thing that you dislike from the rules? Because we kind of all hit what we liked. So what's a new rule that you've seen, or maybe something you didn't see that you disliked?
Mike, what you thinking, buddy? You got a look on your face.
I'm actually just trying to think of something that I actually don't like.
I could go into something real quick to give you a little more chance to think. And it's something we talked about earlier that I was hoping to see. And it's a very weak dislike. Like, I don't this is not a game breaker. This is not like, oh, let me get rid of all that ad mech I just bought. Ah. No, it's I was really, really hoping for alternating activations. And that's because from an engagement point of view, if you're playing a huge game, there's a point where you just stop paying attention to what the other guy's doing because you're waiting to see what the board state's going to be at the end of his turn when you can actually start acting again. I hope in the future that eventually they do get to that because I find it makes a more dynamic game. The games that have alternating activations for me tend to be more dynamic and keep me more invested.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm actually kind of surprised that we don't see that. Sigmar doesn't do that, right?
No, Sigmar does not.
But Kill Team,
Sigmar, Necromunda. Sigmar does it on the skirmish rules level.
Okay.
But not in the big army game.
And I believe, I've only played one game of it, but I believe Apocalypse has alternating.
Yes, Apocalypse does, which is part of the reason why I was expecting it to be in there.
Yeah, yeah, because, I mean, you know, 40K is the flagship for GW, whereas AOS and all these other, you know, IPs have tended to be more like feeder systems almost, like they test rules there, and then those go up to 40K, and we do see a little bit of that currently with the new rule set.
Right, with the new command point generation at the beginning of the turn.
Maybe that'll be 10th edition, start the rumor engine now.
You heard it here first, folks. You heard it
here first. 10th edition, we're starting the timer, it'll be here in about 4 years. That's my prediction.
I could share more of a concern that I have.
Yeah, that works too.
I'm concerned about how new detachments are working, where and especially for a game that we just talked about, it's trying to be a narrative thematic game. I have one Imperium army because I sold the Raptors that I had. So I have one Space Marines Hero army, and that's the Death Watch, and I have Inquisitors, right? And so with the new system, I'm worried because I like to play my Death Watch Order Xenos Inquisition as a narrative game. If I'm playing somebody that's like, yeah, I'm going to bring a bunch of Dune Crawlers, or I'm going to bring a bunch of this or that, or some goofy stuff to the table, and I just want to play a fun game, a beer and pretzels game, I'm going to bring out my Death Watch because I think it's cool, and I'm going to, you know, make a story behind it. Like, this Inquisitor found you were using heretical technology, and we're going to shoot you off the board, basically. I'm worried that in 9th it's not going to have that possibility anymore, and we're going to have this kind of problem.
So, just from the little bit of previews I've seen from, like I said, people that have the product that have been posting YouTube videos, you actually might not have that much to worry about because the game, for match play, they have a built-in attachment or detachment limit. So you could do it at detachment of your Marines. It's whatever the biggest detachment you could do. Well, I'm just saying in general. Yeah. And then you still have enough room to do another detachment that's just your Inquisition.
Right.
And it might not be a battalion or whatever. It'll depend on what you want your Warlord to be and all that.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, like, you're probably only going to be getting 2 to 3 detachments to the table anyway.
Well, right.
Well, in a 2,000-point game for match play, it was always 3 detachments is what the max was in 8th edition. I think they instituted that early on in 8th because people were spamming, like, you know, 40 patrol detachments and crazy crap like that.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, just please, Games Workshop, please don't forget about the narrative component.
Oh, and I think that I think you're relatively safe there just because of the way that detachments behave now. It's not, for a lot of players, it's in their best interest to just do the one single biggest detachment because otherwise they're paying CP.
Right.
So you're going to have to pay like a 1 CP tax or a 3 CP tax or whatever. I think they're 3 for all the non-HQ ones.
Yes, like the Vanguard, the Outrider, Spearhead. They're all 3 command points.
Yeah, so you'll pay 3 CP to get that in your Inquisition, but you'll still be able to do both.
I feel like it's a little bit much for 3 CP. We'll see how it goes. I mean,
it's the fact that you're getting CP every turn.
Yeah,
is a big deal.
I was concerned about that because when I initially read the whole thing, like you can only regenerate or recoup 1 CP per turn. You know, there's a couple of different relics that kind of seem to be invalidated by that immediately in your main phase. But they have specified,
Yeah, I think they say if you have a, you could have rules that supersede this. Yes, it's just by default.
Yeah.
So,
Okay. So the thing that I both love and hate, are we talking about Salt Mine today? Because if not,
well, we're not really.
Okay. So the painting rule. I mean, it's kind of the elephant in the room. if you guys aren't aware, basically a perfect score in Warhammer 40,000 match play will now be 100 points. You can get 90 points from primary and secondary objectives. that magical last 10 points, though, is if you have a battle standard, I believe, painted army.
Three colors.
And I believe it's three colors and shade.
You have to have a shade on there.
So this right here is covering why that is a bad rule, because what is battle ready has changed so much over the years. Mm-hmm. And I get why they're doing it. I get that, because it's a more attractive game whenever everything's painted. And I know this is a person who has no army completely painted except for my Skaven were.
Paint your shit, George.
I'm trying.
It's a hashtag.
It's going to be a thing now.
We're going to make t-shirts. Paint your shit, George.
I'll buy one. I just don't like the rule. I feel like it's a... I agree. I feel like it's a barrier to entry for new players if someone's going to enforce that rule.
Listen, so here's... Yeah, and I think that what you just said is the most important point there, if someone is going to enforce this rule. Me, I actually kind of like the rule. I've come around to it a little bit. Initially, I hated it because it's like, okay, yeah, but I mean, who's going to be that dick? In a casual game, don't be that dick. You know,
don't be that guy.
Yeah, don't be that guy. Don't be a dick, whatever. And that's a rule that, you know, we kind of touched on briefly last time, you know, with the whole social contract is not being a dick while playing a game. Now, I do think that hopefully that will entice more people to paint their armies. I know that, you know, looking at 120 miniatures that are unpainted is daunting, especially for people that don't frequently paint, because it is, you know, a skill that does take some time and effort to really pick up. But once you do have a painted army, like, it's like a really, like, good feeling. You know, like, I'll go into my second bedroom where my display case is and look at, like, you know, the three or four painted armies that I have and just, like, kind of get a little bump out of that every day. And also, they just look better on the table. But, again, I think it comes back to not being a dick in a casual game and being like, oh, well, the score is, you know, 71 to 80, but I have a fully painted army, so I win the game, you know, or anything shitty like that. I'm also informed by the fact that, you know, I play on the ITC tournament scene, and the three-color minimum is a thing there. So for me, it's not really that huge of a deal.
It makes sense to me in a tournament environment because you're holding that. It's up front to everybody to play this level. That's the expectation. I just think putting in the core rule books means that some people first coming into the game are going to look at it and just bounce off of it.
Yeah.
Well, that's just, you know, for me, it's... There's some models that I don't shade them, like the Dire Wolves I just finished. I didn't shade them because I dry brush them. Yeah. I wanted that fur to look good. I don't care about shade on some Dire Wolves, and if I'm gonna lose out because I have my three colors but I don't have a shade, that wording needs to either be more established or this is only for specific game types. Because if I'm going to a tournament, you should be showing up with your three color minimum anyway. And Games Workshop needs to kind of butt out of that, because unless Games Workshop is doing every tournament and becoming prize support, everything that they're supposed to be doing, you don't get to dictate the rules for how a tournament like ITC does its thing.
Well, and I think that, you know, that's another thing to consider too, because, you know, the tournaments that we have at the store that I frequent, there's never been a painting standard. And I don't really foresee that changing, just because, you know... Because most of the people that play around here don't have fully painted armies. And I'd like to see that change. But, hey, you know, it's not like a tournament organizer is going to cut his attendance in half by being like, you have to have, you know, a battle-ready army. So there's no way that GW can police every tournament organizer in the world into doing this. So,
oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. So I feel like we've kind of covered most of the major news, if not all of the major news.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that next time we'll have some actual Warcaster in hand, and maybe we can talk to you guys about playing our first Warcaster game.
Because
that's going to be fun. And a comedy of errors, I'm sure, going by our learning game from Necromunda.
I already called dibs on the Continuum army. By the way, I already called dibs. Nobody else.
Duly noted.
Are they the evil?
Yeah. Fact? Oh, yeah. They're space dicks.
How dare you?
They're the transhuman we're going to chop off limbs and replace them with cyborg bits faction.
Are there... Lesser evil?
No, yeah, they're all evil, I think.
Good. Well, they're all shades of gray. There's space cops. There's space libertarians and their space they're transhumanists.
Let me just put it this way: the color scheme that I saw was black and red.
Yes, so, that for yeah, they're for definitely Continuum are definitely like more sinister.
I'll have to look into this.
Oh yeah, and you know, in theory, I should be getting the models in the next couple weeks.
Sweet, man.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. And you bought all three armies.
So. Yeah, I went stupid heavy in. So we're going to have some intro armies for everybody. We test it out and see if it's worth continuing long term. Yeah, I hope it is because, yeah, that was a lot of money.
Yeah, it was.
So I'd like to move on from the wargaming to talk about another aspect of the tabletop, because this podcast isn't just wargaming. We obviously enjoy wargaming a whole lot. But one of the things that...
It's not...
Well, oh, Mike looks alarmed. I didn't know that. Well, Mike looks alarmed.
Hey, Mike, should we fire George? No. Just kidding.
I'll paint my shit.
Okay, he's hired back.
You're hired.
So one of the things that I am, was probably my biggest hobby for the longest time and still a very, very big thing for me, is tabletop role-playing games.
Yeah.
And I know from previous conversations, we all have a history with them, but maybe we aren't all as active as we used to be, and maybe that's something that'll change over the course of this. But I'd like to talk about RPGs for a little bit, if that's cool with you guys.
Oh, hell yeah, man.
Yeah, so, man. I'm all about it.
Obviously, this is going to be a little bit more of an intro-type setup where we're talking about what we have history-wise, and then going forward, we'll start having more new segments about RPGs. But... So, Mike, how long has it been since you played a tabletop RPG?
Oh, man, it's got to be like 12 years. I think, like, my group, we played 3.5, I think, was the last time. And I mean, I was the DM for that game. And I think I had about 5 or 6 players that would come over every week. And we had a lot of long-running campaigns. We were starting to get into the Epic Level Handbook. That's how long these guys had their characters for. I mean, we had dual class, some real, you know, like, they were doing some... plane shifting, like some real
they're epic into the stuff. Actual epic scale.
Yeah, I mean, they were really getting into like the higher levels, which made it just a lot of fun. But you know, like everybody in college, when that stuff happens, like Dan, like my one buddy, he moved to Michigan. Another guy's down in Tampa. There's another guy I lost contact with, and a couple more that moved away to, you know, Tallahassee and Georgia. And it's just, you know, when they moved away, I didn't have anybody else to really, and then, you know, kids and family and work and everything else just kind of came in and got in the way. That is to say that I haven't bought things. So actually the Humble Bundles that came out for both Death Watch and Dark Heresy, I picked those up because Dark Heresy just looked incredible. Rogue Trader also as an RPG looks fun. Mm-hmm. And that's more of like a space heist game, with RPGs in it. And then you've got The Inquisition, which is mysteries, and then you've got Death Watch, which is like actions. You're a space marine, you get to like kill a bunch of
I will say this, oriented. those rules, I've looked at those rule books before, and I don't fully understand the rules. I know it's percentile based, but the stuff I would see about Rogue Trader building your actual spaceship was like its own mini game of itself. I would read these threads about how they, like, I made a haunted death trap ghost ship, and I would just get pirates to raid me, and my ship would kill them, and I'd get looted. I'm like, this sounds insane. I love it.
I mean, it does, and it's all like that, and it's all just so much. But like I said, I mean, that's something that I would love to do down the road, is like start 3D printing some corridors, start doing all that, and start building into it. But it's been, I want to say it's been, you know, 3.5, so 2008, 2009 time frame was really in the heyday was when I played. So
nice.
That's been about that long. I did get a Book of Soulbound as well.
Soulbound. We're going to talk about Soulbound in a minute.
Oh, I'm sure we are.
Oh, that Soulbound is nice. What about you, Zach? What you got?
It's actually been a couple of months since my last session of D&D. D&D is the only RPG that I've played, and I am relatively new to it. I think I've been actively playing D&D for 2.5 years now.
I'm assuming it's 5th edition that y'all are playing?
Yeah.
So what's that like? Just kind of like tell me the...
So 5th edition...
Oh, okay.
Is so I started with 2nd edition. I started with AD&D, 2nd ed. My older sister had the Ravenloft box set.
Thaco.
Yeah,
all that.
Whenever 3rd edition launched, I asked somebody what their Thaco was just because of impulse. And they're like, what the hell are you? What? Why? But 5th edition is very much a rollback to that in a lot of ways.
Really?
It's a lot. The impression is, and this is... 3rd edition gave you a crazy framework of rules, in my opinion. It gave you the players a ton of options to interact with that. 5th edition said, we're going to still give players cool tools, but instead we're going to make it more about GM rulings at the table.
So see, that would be cool.
It in some ways it frees up a lot of stuff. I've been running since the whole self-isolation thing started here, I started running an online 5th edition game for some friends using the Roll20 platform. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's still a lot of like crunchy tactical stuff that you got from 3rd ed. But in a lot of ways, it feels a lot closer to 2nd ed for a ton of things. Not everything, but for a ton of things. The other big difference from 3rd edition, since I'm using that as a point of reference, is like, you remember 3rd edition, and well, 3.5 had all those like player option books?
Yeah.
There's been like four of those over the course of the whole thing. They don't release like here's the big book of fighters. That doesn't exist.
Yeah, like the, yeah.
They'll do like, here's a setting book with which will have maybe like three subclass options. They've released maybe two official books that are like, here's just books of player stuff. So it's a lot more adventure focused, and it's a lot more like additional monster manuals and additional settings.
Yeah, I saw that, and it's funny that you say that, because when I would go to game stores, I saw a lot of adventures, and I saw a lot of... Actually, what was really surprising was the miniatures. So 3.5, we didn't really have miniatures. I mean, you would maybe bring like a mini to the game to be like, this is what my character looks like in the real world. But you never did maps, hallways, corridors, items. Really? Okay. No, it was very much just pen and paper.
What we used to do for 3rd edition and 2nd edition, we would have like a dry erase board, and we'd have... We would like draw an aerial... and obviously, D&D, despite what it claims with wanting supporting theater of the mind, in my opinion, D&D has always been a tacticals miniature game. It's the rules are the fact that you're given rules in 5-inch increments.
Right.
Everything's so codified. It's not really theater of the mind. However, it gave you a lot of cheat tools to get you there.
So yeah, I mean, not to cut you off, but you know, as a relatively new player to D&D, one of the things that I was surprised about was how combat-oriented the game seems to be. And maybe that's... I'm sure that a lot of that has to do with the current DM that I have. I DM'd a campaign, and it was very combat-heavy just from the way that I ran it. But it just seems so much more combat-oriented than the actual role-playing that I was expecting.
I play a variety of games, and we'll talk about my variety after we get off of D&D in a minute. But, including some of the ones that you've got as decoration up on the shelf.
I mean, the other one I was going to talk about, which nobody really knew about, was Dragonlance 5th Age.
Yeah, the saga rules.
Yeah, so those were crazy. The cards that had each little attribute on them, and you could trump like specific things like a mysticism orb. Like if you played a mysticism card, it would trump, and you could play another card on top of it.
Yeah. So what I was saying before about the tactical nature of D&D, I feel like D&D as a game rewards you for combat. Like that's what it's built around. They have alternative XP systems, but the default that everybody uses, if you look at the way the classes are, powers are given, it speaks a language of violence towards the rest of the world.
I like that.
I spend a lot of time thinking about role-playing game systems, by the way. But which is funny. So I don't know how much you guys know about 4th edition D&D, but I'm about to probably give a hot take that some of our fans online are going to be like, oh my God.
So can I interrupt really quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
I know very little about 4th ed. And I actually worked for a game store a couple of years back for like 6 months. And I always thought it was interesting that people would talk about 3.5 and 5th, but 4th was never mentioned. So, and so I actually had to ask somebody, what happened?
So here's the thing with 4th edition. 4th edition leaned very heavily into the gamification of D&D. Like and by that I mean like it was a very structured, tight, tactical rules combat game. Okay. I will bring my 4th edition books that I still have later for you to check out, so you can see what I'm talking about. But it took it borrowed a lot of stuff from other media that had taken away from D&D. So like it looked at MMOs and characters all had tags. So like you had the tank, you had the they didn't call it healer, they called it leader. You had defender, leader, striker, and controller.
Right.
And so it was built around this very tight tactical combat game, which when it comes to actual dynamic fights on a battle map, those were the best rules. They had rules for improvising your own attacks, which a lot of people that like to complain about it tend to forget. But in the DMG, they just said, go to this chart. If they're this level, do this. And it was really cool. It's funny. I actually got into... When 4th edition was the edition, I was at a game store up here in Jacksonville. I was visiting from Louisiana because I still lived in Louisiana at the time. And some, we were looking at D&D books, and some kid that was working there, actually, I don't even know if he was working there, but he took the opportunity to talk trash about fourth edition. He's like, oh, I don't know anybody that's an old school D&D fan that likes fourth edition. And I'm like, well, what do you consider for old school? He's like, anything before third. I'm like, well, my buddies and I have been playing since AD&D second ed, and fourth edition's amazing. I like it so much more than third edition, because third edition at that point had gotten bloated. It had gotten huge.
All right.
Now, they did have some problems, but the math and some of the initial things were off, and they did some dumb things in regards to some of the mechanics. But it was a very tight tactical game that I think in this age of virtual tabletops would have been amazing. Like, okay. If my buddies and I still talk about, maybe we should run a fourth ed game on Roll 20. And we might. I don't know. We have so much other stuff. Obviously, I've been playing D&D for a while and stayed pretty active in it. I got out of tabletop, I got out of wargaming and was still heavily involved in tabletop RPGs. My biggest thing that I cut my teeth on when I was in college was the Old World of Darkness.
Okay.
Vampire the Masquerade, Werewolf the Apocalypse, and then Werewolf the Forsaken when they relaunched the game with the new setting. But I'm kind of the guy in my RPG circles that I have all these weird systems sitting on my shelf that I've never gotten to play.
Right.
Like, your love for the Saga system, I have a game I could show you that uses cards in a very similar way that you probably would think was pretty interesting, and I've never gotten to play it because everybody wants to play D&D.
Right.
Which brings us into actually Soulbound, because I feel like Soulbound is the game that'll finally get me to break some people out of D&D and also get, you know, you sitting at a table to play, for example, Mike. So for those of you who don't know, Soulbound is the official Age of Sigmar RPG. And I was signaling for you to flip the switch.
Oh, okay, sorry. Well, I think I broke your
mic. Oh, you broke it. Okay, we're just going to cut this awkward... Just flip it. There we go. Leave it.
Okay.
That's a weird light.
This is spoopy. I love it.
So all this awkwardness, we could just cut.
Yeah, I'll cut from right here.
Okay.
Sorry.
So Age of Sigmar is the... or Soulbound is the official Age of Sigmar RPG. And it is an interesting interpretation of the base rules for the game, right? So they looked at the war game and they said, hey... the wargamers are using D6s. They built the D6 system, and they made it so that you could take all these different characters from the orders of armies of order. You know, you've got your Stormcast character selection. You've got your Cities of Sigmar related guys. You've got your Idoneth Deepkin. You've got your dwarves, both Fire Slayers and Kaordrin Overlords, or how do you say? I can never say that.
Black dwarves.
Yeah, steampunk dwarves, and. It lets you create adventures in this very over-the-top setting, which is one of the things that actually appeals to me about Age of Sigmar over the old fantasy battles. Old fantasy battles was like grimdark fantasy. Like, everything sucks. If you played the old Warhammer role-playing game, the Warhammer Fantasy role-playing game, you're like, I'm a rat catcher. If I last long enough, and no, you literally could be a rat catcher if you don't know about fantasy RPG.
I heard they nerfed that class though. The class it got actually, too powerful.
Yeah, it had something to do with the like followers and anyway. So
like a literal Pied Piper.
I think so, but so in that you went from that game where you were like, I'm a rat catcher, I'm just like a city cut purse who's gonna die of leprosy, to like going to Age of Sigmar where it's like, I'm going to go punch that giant god beast in the nose and he's going to just have to take it because I'm amazing. Like, there's just so much turned up to 11 epic fantasy potential in there.
Cool.
And the fact that, for example, like when Soulbound dropped, they have all these pre-made, like, here's your, they call them archetypes, but you can make your own archetypes. So what is the first thing I do? Start trying to figure out how to make a gunslinger Stormcast.
Sweet.
So there's just a ton of potential in there.
Okay.
The other game that I'm going to take a moment to talk about that I think everybody should check out, if you want a more narrative, we're sitting around telling a story type of game that has a lot of interesting depth but is not necessarily as strict with its rules, it's a game called Blades in the Dark.
Okay.
So Blades in the Dark was kickstarted a few years back. and it's gone to become a very, very popular seller for, now it's being published by a company called Evil Hat, which they make another game called Fate, which is pretty big. But Blades in the Dark is literally like, let's play a crew of thieves in a like Dishonored like steampunk type setting. You're in a city where that's haunted, surrounded entirely by ghosts after a magical apocalypse where there's no sun. But like you make your crew of thieves, and each person kind of has a class, but it's very loose. Like you might be a cutter, which is like their fighter type, but then you can pick up abilities from the Whisper, which is like the weird ghost shaman class type. They're called playbooks in the actual game. But you also have a group, it's called a crew book, and it's the type of thieves you are. So like if we were playing a game and you guys decided we want to be assassins, there is an assassin crew book that gives your group abilities and focus. You could be hawkers where you're like dealers in vice, or you could be bravos where you're like running around being jerks and extorting people and sabotaging things. I ran an intro game of that for the D&D group that I've been running for recently, because we're about to pivot to Blades, and they're like, oh, we're gonna be bravos. And by the end of the first game session, they are at war with another faction and like about to have this big gang war that just kicked up because of the choices they made during that first intro heist and how some of the chants came out. And it's just very, very dynamic, very, very exciting. Josh is actually a player. Friend of the podcast, Josh. He and I had several conversations about it whenever I first met you guys, because he was like, oh, you backed that on Kickstarter? I'm like, yeah, look, my name's right here. But it's phenomenal. And it's another one that they've since reskinned it. There's a Star Wars-esque theme one that they published called Scum and Villainy.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's the same rules. Everything's based off of Blades, but rethemed to make...
Same system, different, yeah.
Yeah, different interpretation to make it work for the genre.
Okay, cool.
But RPG is definitely something I would like to talk about more in the future, introduce you guys to, and talk about new products.
Yeah, definitely.
So, moving on from RPGs, which, like I said, we'll probably be talking about that more in the future. Now let's talk about what our hobby progress is. What have you guys been doing lately? What have you gotten done? Hopefully more than me, because you don't want to have apparently a trending hashtag.
Yeah, I'll kick it off. The only two things that I got fully painted, I talked about them last time, were a Night Lord's Legion Praetor and a Night Lord's Legion Praetor in Terminator armor. I actually spent about 6 hours on the two models combined, but I think the results show they look good. Those are posted up on the Instagram, so check it out. And then I did assemble 5 Night Lords Terminators. My backlog has just massively increased recently, what with the new Flesh Quartz army that I'm staring at. But I'm excited.
I think they're staring back at me. I don't like it.
Yeah, they're hungry.
The Abyss looks back. For me, I actually got a little bit done. So I had these pink insulation foam rocks. And so I was kind of... I went on this kick the other day when I had some time on my lunch break. I had some old trees for trains that I was kind of hot gluing to these things, getting those done. So I got some terrain done, which we played. I finished the desert portion, so I have a board that I can flip the slats over, and it's either a forest or a desert. And we played both forest and desert recently. But I got those done. My Archon is painted, not based. And then I got a Vampire Lord on Zombie Dragon built and primed, but not painted. And then my Dire Wolves are completely done. So I got 5 Dire Wolves done. They're easy. It's just a quick dry brush. Other than that, that's basically been it. I've been 3D printing graveyards, things like that for Sigmar and Necromunda terrain. I still have to do my Tinker Turf. I've got still pretty big backlog.
Yeah, I'm still... So painting-wise, I haven't really gotten too much done. I'm still... cranking away on my Skaven. So my first real attempt at a sub-assembly painting, and that's some of the models. Like, I don't know if you've ever looked at the assembly on a Doom wheel, but trying to get that stuff together and prime properly is a little time-consuming.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm hoping I can finish that off and get my Skaven up to 2,000 points built and painted in the next week or so. But a lot more of my focus has been on still organizing my hobby room, because we finally got some display cabinets up, so we're starting to move some of the stuff that we have painted up in the display cabinets, but also been really concentrating on building terrain as well. I've got some MDF kits from, I believe the name of the company is Black Site Studios, for Relic Blade, that I need to get built, and I've been concentrating on Tinker Turf because Tinker Turf has a relationship with Warcaster and Privateer Press, and they're very heavily plugging that. They've been plugging that as like, hey, this is the unofficial official terrain kit, because they are going to release some terrain, but they haven't said, they haven't really talked about it yet. But Tinker Turf is, in my opinion, really solid. We used it for the Necromunda game, and I loved it. So I'm trying to get more of it done, because I still got that big train maglev depot to build. Yeah. That thing's good. The main reason I haven't built it is just I don't have room to put it anywhere. Like it's
right.
As soon as I build it now, I think it's going to go in my display cabinet just because it will go in there. Like I don't have anywhere else to put it.
Tinker Turf's amazing, though. I love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the big hurdle that just came up, and this is something that was related back to GW's new releases, is a lot of the rumors online was that we were going to get a spray primer for the brass color for the Necrons. And I was planning on using that for my AdMech. So that's why I haven't touched AdMech. And then kind of found out today or yesterday, I forgot when I saw the, like, hey, here's the pre-order price list leaked online. They have the paints, like the new base and the new technical paint for it, but not the spray. So I'm like, I got to rethink my my color schemes.
I don't know, Zach. You buy that? I think it's just he doesn't want to paint his shit.
That's what it sounds like.
That's what it sounds like to me, too.
That's George. It. I'm going to show up with all George. Of my AdMech painted next time. I totally
George.
Won't.
George.
No, you won't.
Paint your shit.
Paint your shit.
Hey, you know, I'd like some advice, though. What kind of primer do you guys think I should use on these flesh eater quartz?
So it depends
black.
On what you're...
Black. Always black.
I think black.
Always black.
I don't... It depends on what you're trying to use. In my opinion, like, I'm not a big fan of using black if you're going to use the contrast paints.
I use Krylon.
No, I use
my primer, so, man. I don't pay that chaos black.
Well, I use Rust-Oleum.
Yeah.
The primer, Rust-Oleum. Black. Always black. You can have whatever color you want for your models primed, as long as it's black.
Oh, okay.
Like, so are you Ford now? Is that where we're going with this? You can have the Model T in whatever color you want as long as it's black?
Yep, you can have it in any color as long as it's black.
No, but what I was saying is if you would want to do contrast paints I've used contrast paints, I feel, a lot more than Mike at this point. But I could be wrong. You've painted a lot with them now.
I can contrast for the flesh, and so I was thinking, Wraithbone, maybe?
Well, Wraithbone's the official, but if you could find a... And the GW official, like Wraithbone and Gracier, there is something to say about their consistency, but as long as you find, I think, a creamy like color, you should get that warm tone you want.
Okay.
Just don't put Wraithbone through an airbrush.
No. That I wouldn't recommend.
I made that mistake.
I live by the brush and I'll die by the brush. So I'm probably
that's fine.
Brush.
If you like to take forever to paint things, that's totally cool.
I get results.
I do. You do. You get phenomenal results.
I love your phenomenal.
I will not say anything about how long anyone takes to paint anything, because y'all are both faster than me. So
hey,
and you have lots of contrast paint.
George.
I do have lots of contrast paint.
George,
paint your shit.
Paint your shit, George. All right. So.
So what about what about games played?
Yeah.
I mean. So, you want to talk about our game first, since it's fresh in our mind?
We had two games of Sigmar.
We did have two games of Sigmar.
So, we played my Legion of Sacrament versus your Squigs.
Yeah, my very Squig skew list, where it's two Manglers, two Bounders, a unit of Hoppers, and two Squig Herd.
Yep.
And then Bob, the Fungoid Shaman.
Yep. And then we had, for my side, we had an Archon, a Mortis engine, two Necromancers, some Chain Rafts, some Skeletons, a Direwolf unit, and Hexwraiths.
If you guys want a pro tip, don't go near the Mortis engine. It will only end badly.
Well, so you kind of made the mistake of positioning, and put your general kind of in the range of Curse of Years, which it was your first time really experiencing what Curse of Years does, but when you found out what it did, because it proceeded to burn you the fuck down, it was very quick.
It was one of those things. It was the first game of Age of Sigmar we had played in a while, so
right.
I had played with Orc in the Black before, so
right, you have
I knew what Age of Years did somewhere in my brain, but that was months ago, so that it like was not in the front of my mind. And then it just went badly.
It went badly.
I will say, I mean, I removed a lot of models. It went really well until it was suddenly not going well.
Right. And the kind of the thing about those guys is there were also some Spirit Hosts in there, and there were some Wraiths. But the thing that kind of the Archon Legion of Sacrament does is it's you have these graveyards that can bring your stuff back.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where you started to have problems was, oh, you may have, you did delete an entire unit of Reapers, but they just came back.
I think the biggest problem I had, because we were playing a scenario where if your victory points were based off of the total wounds you had removed from the table, and if you managed to kill the general, you got to double that. And I think my problem was I did not get my general, who is the killiest model in that army, into your general. I think if I would have managed to get him into Archon, I'm not going to say it would have gone my way, but it would have been a closer game. Because at the end, you were like three times as many points as me because you would kill my general, which doubled everything else.
Right.
And then you almost tabled me, which... because your stuff just kept coming back.
That would have really been kind of what helped you as well, because if you would have been able to sequester Archon back to the edge of the table and kept him to a one model unit with that many wounds on that squig, you could have possibly shut down Archon, because what happens is Archon can't heal if he doesn't remove a model from a unit, right? So he doesn't heal unless he kills something. If you've got it so that your squig and only your squig is in front of him and it's still alive, he's not healing during the time
he's supposed to be. Slowly eating the wounds.
He's slowly eating wounds, and he's going to take a while to knock down, but if you were able to do it, you would have been able to kind of shut everything else down.
And that was, like you said, a lot of it was positioning, but all in all, it was a fun game.
Yeah,
it was
great to be back. Absolutely.
It was great to be back in Age of Sigmar after playing smaller games, just getting to put my squigs back on the table, the Skittles of Doom. Those guys are just fun. Skittles are doing.
That's pretty awesome. And then we had another game just this morning. We played your Ozearch Bone Reapers.
My Bone Reapers versus your Khorne.
Right.
And that was my first attempt at playing them as the Crematorium, the guys that the fiery exploding skeletons, which I will say at the end of the game, and I'll say this after, I was not as impressed with that sub-faction.
Oh, yeah.
They just... it wasn't as impactful as I feel like the Petrifix Elite, which is by far the most powerful sub-faction.
Right.
But still a lot of fun. Lost that one as well. But it was one of those things where... And it was one where I was doing really well until I suddenly wasn't anymore.
Right.
Funny how that happens.
Well, the way the Bone Reapers work and the way the Khorne works in Age of Sigmar... It felt like we were either going to table... One of us was going to get tabled early on. And I didn't table Mike's units fast enough to stop him from summoning a disgustingly giant demon. So...
Not only that, but we also had quite a bit of fun with the Hexcore Skulls.
Oh, yeah.
Which came out and then got positioned to not only...
It is all up in my little wizard cadre.
Oh, it got right into his wizard cadre.
Yeah,
I saw
that positioning in the picture that you guys had sent to me. That looks unfortunate.
with Khorne as well, he loves the number 8. However, casters do not share that same affection. So your casters were within range of the loathsome sorcery aura, which means that you had to reroll your successful ones. You took
it. There was no way to avoid it either.
Like, you just took a -2 on your casts as well, and you had. And if you had happened to roll an 8, what happened?
I basically dealt damage to all the spellcasters that were near those endless prayers, which was all three of my spellcasters, and this was what really killed me though. It countered the spell even though it was successfully cast. And that wizard could no longer cast it.
Jesus.
He forgets the spell.
So the spell that it ate was not the worst spell. It would have been helpful because it would have thinned out all your units because it was a big AoE damage based on that caster. But what really killed it was the damage that it did to all my guys. Like it did not outright kill any of the wizards, but it weakened them enough that the next stiff breeze that hit them just was like, oh, no. Jeez.
Man, well, it did actually kill one of your... It killed your healer.
Oh, no, it killed the healer guy. Yep. That is correct.
To interrupt, as a novice at AOS who hasn't played a game yet and who has only, farted around with the rules, God, I wish World Eaters had shit like that.
In 40K. Oh, yeah. I mean,
you got to reroll your successful spells. And I mean, like, yeah, sure, the psychic phase is the end-all, be-all. But, man, that just having that activity within another phase would be so great.
Well, what's even cooler about it is they are flying skulls weeping blood.
Yeah, so just, the models are just phenomenal. Yeah, I've seen
them. They're cool. I want to get some and use them as, like, a display board or something.
They follow you around.
For my Chain Axe boys.
And they just scare the shit out of you, and I love it. And then also, but you know, lore wise, that battle was pretty big. It felt monumental, and it actually drew enough ire of Khorne that he decided he was going to also throw a wrath axe at you. Yep. So I mean, he rended reality and threw a giant axe, which then went through and chopped up some warrior guys. But you know, my list was that's kind of the if you're going to play Khorne and you're going to play semi-competitive, which when you said you were bringing your Bone Reapers, I said, okay, well, I'm not going to bring my fluffy death list. I'm going to bring kind of my little bit bigger and better. And it's not fully net list, but it was, you know, it was a Gore Pilgrims Battalion. And it was, you know, you had some pretty interesting stuff in there. Some Wrathmongers, which are just barbed wire, basically.
Honestly, we were up till that summon the way the objective worked is there were six objectives on the board, and there was a chance one of them would be the turn out to be the true treasure that we were hunting for. And until it ended up on the wrong side of the board, once it got revealed and it was in the middle of all your troops that were still and your heroes and not where my general was camping out, because that's where I really wanted it to be. That was kind of when I'm like, okay, this is a downward slide, but we're going to play it through to the end because I want to see how many of my dudes might kills.
And it killed. I think you got tabled almost, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, I conceded whenever I had just my Leech Cavalos.
Right.
Just my generals on the board. And he would have stayed in a while because he's pretty tanky, but that it was just going to be downhill.
Not a Wrath of Khorne Bloodthirster.
No.
I think you're going to eat some wounds for that one. And then the you know, we had some the Skull Reapers did some work. They knocked out quite a bit, and then the Wrathmongers really kind of helped. The thing that mechanic did was so Gore Pilgrims got kneecapped a little bit, so now it kind of the Wrath icon and all of its buffs from the Blood Secretor kind of increases by 8. It used to be increased by 8 for every Slaughter Priest within range, but now it's only increased by 8 whenever there's a Slaughter Priest. So you can have multiple Slaughter Priests, but you're not going to get that buff. So if you had 3 Slaughter Priests and you're at it, you had 40 inches like of aura, you know, that's pretty crazy. Now it's just 8, so you have to be smart about where you put the Blood Secretor. And you also, if you take out the Blood Secretor, your entire battalion now falls apart. Like, that is your weak linchpin of 5 wounds. If you can get to him, that's how you do it. You have to play smart with your positioning. It didn't help that we kind of just said, here's your deployment zone, here's my deployment zone, and both of our armies are right at the edge of the deployment zone.
Once you deployed right at the edge of my deployment zone, I had to play aggressive because I could not play far enough back.
Right.
You know, like...
It was going
to
be...
And my units, my more mobile units were on the wrong side of the board to get to that guy.
So...
It was just the way... The positioning game was not in my favor.
So we just kind of... It ended with... Basically, Khorne, you know, the Bone Reapers like bones, and Khorne likes skulls, so it was natural that they were going to have that fight. Khorne got some skulls for the Skull Throne today, so it's pretty fun.
As it should be.
So what about you, Zach? What games have you played recently?
Yeah, I was able to play on Wednesday. I was fortunate enough to get a day off. Played with a guy named Dave Karen, friend of the show. Dave's a big Nurgle guy, but he has recently expanded his horizons and now has plenty of different Chaos stuff. You know, he did play a Chaos list against me. He had a super heavy detachment with a Chaos Knight and two of the Baby Knights with auto cannons with the War Dog Helverins, I want to say, the Baby Knights. He had that. He brought Mortarion, this being the first time I've actually played against Mortarion, surprisingly. And then he had some Mephitic Blight Haulers and the Lawnmower things, the Fetid Bloat Drones or something like that. I brought the exact same list that I played against Mike. So I had a rapid-fire battle cannon, dual rapid-fire battle cannon, Chaos Knight, along with World Eaters Battalion, just a pretty standard Rhino Rush with some Red Butchers Terminators, and three Blood Slaughterers, Demon Ticks. This game did not go well.
I was about to ask, how'd that go for that night?
It did not go well. Yeah, kind of the same situation, actually, is with Mike. you know, Dave knows that I play competitively, and so knowing that we were going to play a game, he did build a more competitive list. I didn't, which is fine. You know, I'm not trying to malign Dave or anything like that. It's good to play, you know, against strong stuff. So yeah, Dave went first. This was an ITC match. Dave went first and immediately killed my Chaos Knight. So it didn't do anything, which was sad. And I was really playing at a disadvantage, obviously, for the rest of the game. We did play the game out fully. I'm trying to pull up my app right now to figure out how many points he put up on me. I know it was a loss, blah, blah, blah. Yes, yeah, so the game ended 37 Dave, 16 me. I think we actually played like three full turns. And then I conceded and we kind of talked it out. But yeah, man, Nurgle just... sucks playing against a list where everything's like toughness 7 or above and has a 5-up feel no pain. And for everyone that's played against Dave, he does a thing that I like to call Dave Carandice, where he just makes a ton of feel no pain rolls.
That's exactly like George's.
Yeah, yeah.
I invoked the power to gash and just was like, no, I'm not taking 7 wounds. Yeah, that's like, not happening.
No, thank you.
But Zach, I mean, it's but Zach Papa Nurgle loves you.
He does, yeah. Hashtag bless, hashtag Nurgle, hashtag Papa. yeah, so, I mean, it was kind of a rough game, but, you know, it was still fun. Dave's a great guy, good to play against, really, you know, does embody Nurgle in all the positive ways in that he's jovial and friendly, and none of the negative ways in that he bathes. yeah, I mean, it was a good game. Yeah, it was a bit of a tough loss. Just, you know, kind of feel badsies from losing your big centerpiece model right in the first turn. But, hey, it would have happened to him if I had gone first. So it's all good. And those are my games played. Kind of light. I try to go for 2 games a week, but kind of missing out.
Cool deal. So I definitely think next week might try and get some Relic Blade in. Maybe we can talk about you guys trying out a smaller indie game. Hopefully I can finish getting that terrain together in time. But I guess now it's that time where we talk about cool shit.
Cool shit.
So does either of you guys have some cool stuff you want to share? Some things you noticed, Zach?
Yeah, what you got for me? I'll go for it because I was woefully unprepared last time. I am actually prepared now. I self-shamed into it. Yeah, so just farting around on Kickstarter, one thing I found, and this will be in the show notes. Mike already sent it to you, the link. It's on Kickstarter. It's called Hexhog Tables, Hinterland Hills. So basically what this is, you back the campaign, and it's like over 200% backed right now, so it's going to happen. But you back the campaign for, I think it's like $20 or something is their first pledge level, and that gets you access to STL files. And basically what these are for you to print off are hexes. They have like base hexes, and then on top of that you can build up like hill terrain. And it looks like, you know, once it's fully assembled and painted, looks like, you know, it's pretty realistic and pretty cool terrain while also being very modular. And so, you know, for, you know, if you dumped, you know, $100-$200 into this campaign, it looks like you'd be able to outfit like a full like 4x6 table.
Nice.
And even smaller than that, just the, like, I mean, I think that this would really be great for like combat oriented RPGs like D&D or others. In that you can run like, you know, woodland encounters and stuff like that. So I think it looks pretty cool. Check it out, you know, always back it. If you think it looks cool, help people that are independent out. So yeah, that's my cool shit.
What about you, Mike? What you got for us?
So actually mine's also from Kickstarter. Cool. It's called Valis Mortis, and it was released by Tom Tullis of Fat Dragon Games. He started out with $1,000 pledge goal. He hit 82,000. Almost 83. He's almost at 83,000 now. So Valis Mortis is 3D printable fantasy terrain, kind of like your Hinterland stuff. And it's for RPGs. But he kind of, it's so cool looking. It's cities, streets, cobblestones, items, miniatures. And I'm just looking at this going, man, this is going to be great for Frostgrave. Man, this is going to be great for Sigmar. And, you know, maybe something else later on for D&D or whatever else we decide to play. You know, this is a good thing. So, you know, there's some pledge goals. It gets pretty up there, but it looks like the pledge level that I'm mostly looking at and that I'm actually going to consider is $75, which is basically all the buildings. I've used and printed stuff from Fat Dragon before, and these guys actually are not only just very informational. They help you. They make settings for slicing their stuff, and they give it to you for free. So they basically say, here's a profile to print our stuff. And I first came into contact with them during Humble Bundle. They were giving away some stuff, and I've 3D printed a lot of their things, and they come out looking great. So I definitely think this one's worth a watch for sure, because I'm really looking forward to that, as well as, you know, Frostgrave 2.0 is coming out in August. I did pre-order that book, and
I didn't realize that was up for pre-order. I'm gonna have to go track that down myself.
Yep. So yeah, and the other thing that I found was Dungeons and Lasers. So Dungeons and Lasers is modular terrain as well. They've been around for a while. You can clip them together just like any of the other, you know, terrain lock systems. But this one has sci-fi, and so
did you actually ever send off for their sampler? Because they actually had a free sampler. I don't know if it's still offered, but I have some actual samples from one of their kits.
Yeah. And I'm thinking that looks perfect for Necromunda. Looks perfect for Dark Heresy.
It's really cool.
Any kind of tactical RPG is going to be great for that. So,
and it came in a cool little miniature dog.
Oh, they do give you the little doggy. Yeah. I did see that. So that's really cool, and I'm looking forward to that one. Those are kind of the three things that I've been kind of looking at going, yeah, great.
So I've also got a couple Kickstarters. Mine are more on the RPG end than terrain or miniature games. I know I talked about Warcaster and Obsidian Protocol previously, but these two games, the first one I'm going to talk about is hopefully before the episode drops, it'll still be going on. It's going to end on July 10th. So if you listen to this past July 10th, too late, it's gone. It's called Terra Oblivion, and it's a pre-apocalyptic sci-fi game. It's a game about a world that's on a sci-fi world that's on the brink of the apocalypse. And the what sold me on this game is the mechanics are pretty solid. Like, from what I've seen, it was a system that looked pretty good. It's actually based off of the old D6. If I'm not mistaken, it's based off of the old D6 DC Supers game. Mm-hmm. But the setting, all the technology is like weird, like partially tech, partially symbiotic with alien life forms from the planet.
Right.
And like humans are colonists there, and the planet's about to go absolutely horrible because of the human involvement there. It's just a very interesting setting that I was instantly sold on by the art. The other game is, this one's ending on July 30th, so you got plenty, a lot more time for this one. It's called Slayers, and it's a much smaller scope indie game about monster hunters in this little town. You have a couple different asymmetric classes, so every class plays a little different. You got like a gunslinger and a fencer type guy and a tactician and a wizard, and you're running around killing monsters in a very, feels... The setting very much made me think of like Dark Souls.
Right.
Or that sort of like dark gothic type setting, which are both really, really cool. The last cool stuff, and if I talked about this before, I apologize for repeating myself, but just kind of want to give a shout out to Restoration Games for a couple different reasons. First of which is they did this really cool thing. So for those of you children of the 80s, you might remember an awesome game that just recently got redone within the past couple of years called Fireball Island.
Yes. Which
Fireball Island, for those of you who aren't aware and haven't had a chance to run off the Board Game Geek to look at it yet, was this monstrosity of plastic where you would like try and move up this shape like an island, and you're trying to move up to the big volcano idol thing at the top and steal treasure before the idol gets you. But the way the idol gets you is that you toss marbles into the idol, and then it just like goes down these plastic course that you're on. So like you get run over by the fireballs. Restoration Games specializes in taking old games and revitalizing them. And they've produced some of my favorite board games to come out recently, and they've got some really, really good ones on the horizon. But specifically with Fireball Island, they recently did a very cool pay what you can sale where they said, look, we've got X amount left. We're about to do another print run. We're just going to sell what we have left at a pay what you want or pay what you can thing. But all their profits were being donated to charity. I managed to get a copy of that because, as you can imagine, it sold out really quickly, but it's a very upstanding thing to do because that game was super in high demand. They could have just kept selling it at retail and made a good bit of money. But some projects they have coming up that I really want to plug is, I don't know if either of you remember a board game called Key to the Kingdom.
No.
Key to the Kingdom's big thing was that it had a board and you were like a warrior knight type adventurer traveling across trying to complete this quest in this fantasy land. but there were these magic portals, and if you got into the magic portal space, the board would fold open and reveal more board.
Oh, cool.
And everybody who was on the section of board whenever a player jumped into the portal got sucked into the portal with them. So it was just a very interesting exploring game that was a big part of my childhood. Like, I had that as a kid, and I loved it. And they're doing, they've announced that they have the license for that. And they've also teamed up with Mondo to make a game called Unmatched. And I don't know if either of y'all remember, this was around the time the Star Wars prequel trilogy came out. They had, used to have a board game called Star Wars Epic Duels, I think was that. It was a card-driven kind of miniature game.
I remember that.
They took that system, refined it, and scrubbed out the Star Wars and made Unmatched. And there are several sets of Unmatched. They teamed up with Mondo, the t-shirt company, to get some pop culture licenses. And you basically, all the boxes are compatible. It's a card-driven miniatures combat on a very cool board. But the sets are insane. So the first set, you could pick Alice in Wonderland, Sinbad the Sailor, King Arthur, or Medusa. But, and fight. But then the later sets added, like, Bruce Lee. They added Raptors versus the Hunter from Jurassic Park. They added in Robin Hood versus Bigfoot. The last set added in Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Jekyll slash Hyde, Dracula, and the Invisible Man.
See, and now you're getting into stuff that, like, I wasn't into it until you started saying, like, oh, occult.
Well, so they're also, basically, they're releasing some sets on their own, and then they're releasing some sets as official licenses, and those are done with partnership. So there's another Jurassic Park set coming out. I know they're doing a Buffy the Vampire Slayer set.
Right.
So, like, and I literally got to play a match where it was my buddy playing Bruce Lee and I was playing Robin Hood. And some characters have little dudes, so I like had all these outlaws because I was Robin Hood. And Bruce Lee was just mowing through my dudes slowly, slowly getting closer. And I won the match by point blank shooting him in the face with a bow, like right before he murdered me. It's super dynamic. I'm going to bring it by later for you guys to try out because it is a quick, fun little game.
Awesome.
Question.
Yes.
Does it have the Brad Pitt character from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood where I can throw Bruce Lee into a Ford Falcon?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, take notes.
Your own.
I'm going to make one.
So I'm just going to point out, you could have Sasquatch versus Bruce Lee versus Dracula versus Velociraptors.
Fantastic.
This sounds like a board game like a seven-year-old would make up, and like, I'm so here for it. That's
like
amazing.
Zero clicks, but not limited.
Almost. Oh, no. It's just, it's insane, and it's amazing.
R.I.P. Hero clicks. I don't know. I never understood really how to play the game. But it was super cool to have Batman, Colossus, and, you know, like, the Thing all fighting against, like, Cyclops, Apocalypse, and Magneto.
Right, yeah.
I had whenever that first came out and I was in college, I managed to pull Mr. Fix-It, the Hulk. You know, the mobster, the Hulk, in one of my first packs. I'm like, what are you doing? I'm just going to beat everybody up as Mr. Fix-It.
Right.
Well, guys, I believe that's all we've got for today, so...
Yep, and as always, any of the stuff we talked about will be in the show notes on ttdpodcast.com. Links to all the Kickstarters.
Yeah, we did stand up our social media presence, so we've got Twitter, which I don't remember the handle.
It's at Tabletop Dropouts.
Fantastic. Yeah, we've also got Instagram, which is Tabletop Dropouts, and Facebook, which is also, you guessed it, Tabletop Dropouts. So, so give that a like, subscribe, all that good stuff to follow us.
Yeah, and, you know, thanks for listening.
Yeah,
we'll
thanks,
be
guys.
Back again.
See you guys next time.